The first time Will Liverman ever attended the opera, he fell asleep in the first few minutes. It wasn't long, though, before he discovered that opera was for him. He was 13 years old at the time. He's now a very well-known baritone who's been at opera houses around the globe, including the Metropolitan Opera. He's won a number of prestigious awards, and he says that this humbling experience has inspired him to continue to invest in new projects, like the one we're going to sample from today on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. It's called Dreams of a New Day, Songs of Black Composers by Will Liverman. I'm Julie Almacher. Will, let's start off by just having you introduce yourself to our listeners a little bit. Tell us where you grew up and what things were like for you as a kid.
Yeah, so my name is Will Liverman, and I was born and raised in Virginia. And yeah, as a kid, I grew up with a big gospel background and started off singing in the choir. And I did lessons as a kid and also did a lot of gospel piano. So that was like sort of my introduction into music. And when I was a little bit older, I attended the Governor School for the Arts in Norfolk, Virginia, which was an all performing arts high school. And that's where I was introduced to opera. And from there, I just, you know, through my from my freshman year to senior year, I did this program. And it really inspired me to pursue classical voice and the collegiate level. And that's how my path began as an opera singer. I went on to Wheaton College for my undergrad, and then my grad school is at Juilliard. And then I moved to Chicago to do the Ryan Opera Center at Lyric Opera of Chicago for 3 years. And then after that, I've been freelancing and, you know, I made my way into the professional circuit.
So I think if I read this correctly, you were about 13 when you were first exposed to opera. And that is not something that most 13-year-olds would warm up to instantly. How did you know it was the right thing for you?
You know, it wasn't, I didn't take to it right away, to be honest. Like the first show I saw was Die Walküre by Wagner, and I promptly fell asleep like 20 minutes in. But I remember waking up to this tune of The Ride of the Valkyries, because I had no idea that that tune was from an opera. You know, I've heard it on cartoons and like a lot of mainstream commercials and stuff. But when I heard that, like, dun 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 bum ba da bum, and it gets louder and louder, and I see like the Valkyries come on stage, and just something about that experience just really was jaw dropping to me. It was like this larger than life thing. And then when we took trips with the Governor School, we took trips down to the Metropolitan Opera, and we watched some performances there. We were sitting way up in the nosebleeds, but you know, there was something that I was drawn to about hearing a voice unamplified, you know, singing over an orchestra. And it was just a different type of art form that I was just really fascinated by and decided this was something that I wanted to do.
Did you see any correlation between that and the gospel music you were raised with?
Not at first, but as over time, like I think there are some similarities. I mean, first of all, I think, you know, the emotion behind both styles is something that's just very, you know, heartfelt and soulful in a way. And I always joke around, like, if you add some ninth chords and seventh chords to Mozart, it sounds pretty gospel. You know, it's all the same 12 notes. And, you know, it's just there's more in common than you think with opera and gospel. And I love it. You know, I love both genres, and the things that are in both of those different forms like have helped make me the musician that I am.
At what point did you realize that doing classical music and opera in particular was something you could actually do and that you might be able to make a living at it?
I think probably when I started to do more programs, and just I did a lot of competitions, and I had a lot of really great support, like along the way, great voice teachers who encouraged me to say, you know, you really have something here. This is something you should pursue. And, you know, Robert Brown, who was a big mentor of mine, he passed away, but he was my, you know, musical mentor in Virginia. And he's the one that sort of set me on that path and saw something in me you know, really encouraged me to pursue opera in the first place.
When labor is light and the morning is fair, I find it a pleasure beyond all compare to hitch up my nag and go hurrying down and take Katie May.
Riding to Town is sort of my tribute to him, because that was one of the first art songs I ever learned that he assigned to me. And like every baritone who is in the at Governor's School, their one piece that's kind of the happy that breaks up all of the heaviness of it.
If the road could be made twice as long.
So that was sort of my tribute and shout out to Robert Brown for the Riding to Town piece by Thomas Kerr Jr. But I've had a lot of great people in my corner who've really believed in me and, you know, sort of pushed me in that direction. And I just stayed true to that. And, you know, of course, it's not the easiest path trying to pursue a career in opera, but I, you know, stayed with it. I found a lot of different, everything that I could get my hands on it and do and audition for, I did. And, you know, eventually that developed into something that I was doing full time. So,
what's been most challenging for you in pursuing this as a career?
I'd probably say coming out of a young artist program, I'd say the main thing is making that bridge from a young artist to a professional. Because the thing is, you know, once you kind of take that leap off into, you know, the professional world, you're competing with everyone, you know, like people that have been around in the business for years and years, and you're competing for the same jobs. And it can be a challenge to get your name out there and stick with it, because the gigs for me, you know, it's different for everyone. But for me in particular, you know, I didn't come out of the gate with a lot of gigs. I had to sort of work my way up and take everything that I could just to build my name, you know, websites, doing auditions, competitions, like all those things matter and all those things just help propel me. But, you know, they always say, though, that it's those initial years between a young artist and professional, like trying to bridge that gap, are the most challenging, I would say.
What has allowed you to be successful? I mean, what have you done that's allowed you to really succeed? I mean, I know that you're still kind of at the beginning of your career, but you have some incredible credentials already.
Oh, thank you. No, I would say, you know, I always kind of look at it with, when it comes to auditioning, there's like two auditions for a company. You have your audition to like get your foot in the door, and then you have an audition to get rehired. And so when I was doing, you know, my debuts and getting into these opera companies, the goal was to make sure that you get rehired, because that's how you build the career. You know, people can sing everywhere once, but you know, if you're not a good colleague, or you're, you know, not being nice to people that you're working with and you're hard to work with, like, folks are not going to hire you. So it's really about, it's more than just the music and having a great voice. You have to really be a nice person, someone who's easy to get along with. And those things add up, because the opera world is small. And it's those type of things where people can look at that and say, oh yeah, we hired Will for this gig and he was great to work with, easy, you know, wasn't a problem. And that's how you get rehired at one place and make a debut at another. So I think a lot of that really helped. And of course, doing a lot of my own marketing, you know, not waiting for permission to record my own stuff and get my name out there that way in a digital world, all those things sort of really helped to propel me, I think.
What do you think has been your most important operatic role to date so far, and why?
That's hard. I would say,
I was just going to say, or maybe it was just your favorite, the one that really knocked your socks off being able to do it.
There's a few, the one that comes to mind, I would say, is doing Papageno, I think, at the Met, because that was like a big dream come true, especially being a high schooler, you know, kind of coming back full circle, going to Governor's School and going to the Met for the first time and seeing, you know, what that is like, being in the Mecca of the arts in New York City, and, you know, and then to come back, you know, years later and sing in the Magic Flute in a role that I love. And not only that, I hadn't realized at the time, Later we found out through research that I was the first Black Papageno to sing on the Met stage. There's a lot of significance and meaning behind doing that as well. And it's something that sticks out in my mind. And I'm honestly glad that it happened, because that was like one of the last things I did right before the pandemic too.
Yeah, everything's really changed since the pandemic. How has it impacted what you're doing? I know you have equipment in your space there, which has allowed you to do some music. Tell us about what you have been doing.
Yeah, the pandemic, of course, has been devastating for the classical world and for artists who've lost work. But I think what we're finding in that, and having a lot of different conversations with people, is this digital aspect of, having a way to go beyond the stage and reach a different audience who may not necessarily go to the opera. So when you start investing time, money, and energy into, making music and having it available to be consumed digitally, whether that's Spotify or iTunes or, putting out more things in your Instagram, I think those things we're finding are really important for the opera world to recognize that live performance, nothing can replace that, obviously. As a performer, that energy in the room, the working with colleagues, the feeling and hearing the live orchestra, I mean, those things are all what make the art so special. But in addition to that, I think coming out of this pandemic, we need to increase our digital presence to broaden our audiences and to bring visibility and accessibility to people who may not necessarily step foot in the opera house. So for me, I've been able to do some of that. I composed an opera, which we workshopped with Lyric Opera in December. So it's really given me a lot of time to sit and think and be creative in different ways and step outside the box. So that's been really nice.
What's the opera you composed?
It's called The Factotum. It's based off of Barber of Seville, actually. That's why I had the idea when I was doing a lot of barbers, and it's based in a Black barber shop and present day. And it was something that I've been working on for years, but it was sort of, under the radar. I was working a lot at the time. So it was just something that my collaborator and I were just doing just because we wanted to, and we wanted to tell new stories and, fuse a lot of the music that we grew up with, like gospel and R&B and hip hop, and sort of fuse the operatic voice into that. So that's how we created it. And we thought of the original story and, who would these characters be in present day? And long story short, when the pandemic hit, we were raising support and money to, produce our own workshop. And Lyric Opera, they lost their season. And so they were looking for alternative programming. And through word of mouth, they heard about what we were doing. And then next thing you know, we workshopped the piece with them. And it's actually available to look at. They documented that, the Factotum, and that whole week of what we did during the workshop. And it's on the lyricopera.org website called Creating the Factotum. So that's been something that's come out of this pandemic, which has been really special. And we're hoping, for full production with that and, kind of going the whole nine with the digital content with the opera. So that's really been fun.
Oh, that's awesome. I have one more question, and then we're going to dive into your new recording. You have been the recipient of some pretty significant awards, especially recently: the 2020 Marian Anderson Vocal Award, the 2019 Richard Tucker Career Grant, and a Sphinx Medal of Excellence. Congratulations, first of all. What does winning or receiving these types of awards mean to you?
It's honestly, I mean, it's a cliche thing to say, but it is truly humbling, because, you don't expect to be rewarded for what you're doing. I don't think that's ever a good attitude to head into a career. I mean, you do it because you love it. I've always, especially, where I'm at now, want to be an advocate for diversity in the arts and inclusion. And it's a passion of mine. And to be recognized for the things that I've done, and works and performances that I've done, and to receive these awards is truly a special thing to me. Especially looking back and seeing, folks that have won these awards in the past, to be in that number is an honor. And because it didn't have to be like that. They could have gone to someone else. So it really is. I really take these things to heart, and it inspires me even more to continue the work that I'm doing and in using those investments as a way to give back and investing in new projects. And so that's, you know, it's really been an honor to receive those awards.
Has that helped you invest into this opera project that you were just talking about?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, with some of what I've, you know, had from those awards that I had saved up, plus, you know, raising money through 3Arts. Shout out to 3Arts. They're another nonprofit here in Chicago. When I won an award with them in a few years back, and that platform allowed me to do like a crowdfunding thing to raise money for working on the opera virtually. But all of it's helped. Like winning these awards has helped me, you know, put together a CD and multiple CDs actually. And it's just really helped give me, you know, creative freedom to do the things that, you know, are important to me and tell stories that are important to me.
One of those things that's very important to you is a passion project that you recently released, which is lifting up the songs by Black composers. It's called Dreams of a New Day. Why did you want to do this project? Why was it so important to you?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few things. I think, one, I wanted to tell Black stories. You know, I think that's a big mission of mine, is to continue to tell our stories, because, you know, I mean, there's so much great standard rep out there that we do time and time and time again. But I think we have to, and a lot of companies and people are doing this with new commissions, but I think we have to still push to write and create things that, you know, are relevant. So that's on one end. And then mainly I wanted to highlight composers for their contributions in art song. Honestly, there's so much that I didn't know about the repertoire that Black composers are writing. I mean, I knew about the spirituals, but I think, you know, oftentimes, you know, a special thing, you know, you have your Schubert, your French, and your new song, and then you end with the spiritual. And like, but you know, there's Black composers are writing spirituals, but they're also writing art songs. And I feel that we don't really highlight that enough, or people don't know enough about these art songs that the composers have written. So I wanted this album to showcase that, along with commissioning something new and telling new stories. So how this album came to be is I found this poem, Ballad of Birmingham, and I was doing a lot of research on the civil rights movement after talking with my dad, you know, who grew up in Virginia, in the segregated Jim Crow Virginia. And it just really, you know, kind of shook me, just really thinking about, this is my father who's going through all these things. And I don't know, I stumbled upon the Ballad of Birmingham, you know, about the Birmingham bombing. And I gave it to Sean O'Peblo, who's a Chicago-based composer here. And we worked on a project back in 2013 of his reimagined spirituals. So I really knew I wanted him to set this. So I commissioned him to write this piece. And then he had the idea to do a sort of a parallel to the Charleston shooting. So he commissioned Marcus Amaker to write a poem specifically for this song cycle. And that became the focal point of the album.
I want to talk a little bit more about Two Black Churches. This is the world premiere recording of this two-movement work. However, you were able to perform it at Kennedy Center in a recital that was in conjunction with you winning the 2020 Marian Anderson Vocal Award. How did the audience respond to this piece?
Yeah, it's truly a powerful thing. And it's like the first few times where I tried to sing it, when I heard it for the first time, I had a hard time getting through the piece, because it, you know, it is something that's so poignant. When I think about my own experience growing up in church, and to think of something so devastating and terrible that could happen, you know, it took a long time to find that balance of telling the story but not going too deep. And the way Sean writes it really is like a true back and forth between the voice and piano.
She clawed through bits of glass and brick, then lifted out a shoe.
Like this extended journey, and you really have to sit with this thing. It's no short little like 3 minute thing. I think it's why, you know, people really have time to sit and process what it is we're delivering, and, you know, the black churches at the Kennedy Center, I remember specifically, it was silent. People are really moved by the peace.
Can you share the story behind the two churches, the stories that each movement is telling?
The first one, what struck me about Battle of Birmingham was, I mean, you know, it talks about the bombing of the four girls who were going to Sunday school. And this poem, the first one, is from the perspective of one of the girls. And, you know, she's asking her mom to, you know, march the streets of Birmingham for freedom, for equality. And her mom keeps saying, you know, she's worried. She says no to her and says, you know, I'm worried that the dogs are gonna, you know, attack you, or you'll get shot or hosed, or, you know, any number of things that were happening during that time. But then she says, you know, but you can go to church and sing in choir, because in mom's mind, it's a place of safety and a place of tranquility and peace, which is the heartbreaking thing of it all, because she's sending her daughter actually to death's door, thinking that's a place where she's going to be safe. That's what's really the tragic thing about that.
Go to church instead and sing in the children's choir.
And then with the rain, it talks about the Charleston shooting.
When the reality of racism returns.
And the rain signifies two things. One, in Charleston, it floods a lot. And two, it's sort of this continuing narrative of how Black people are just always trying to stay afloat, always having to come back to these issues of racism and justice. And so that's sort of the tie between it. And that's how Two Black Churches came to be.
In that second movement, The Rain, there are so many mood changes. And one of the things that you're often complimented for is the flexibility in your voice. And I have to tell you, and this is just one of many examples, about 3 minutes in, you're just hitting these high notes with such ease. They just float up there, and you're a baritone, I'll remind everyone. That can't be easy. How do you do that? How are you able to do that with such ease?
I have to give props to, like, my gospel chops, honestly. I think that sort of style, that sort of floatiness, comes from my singing and upbringing in church, you know. And my mom was actually a gospel singer. She still is, you know, a gospel singer. And I think that the way Sean had written that particular passage was very, had a lot of gospel flair in it. And so it just allowed me to kind of utilize that part of my voice. And that's all that is just, it was just so easy for me to feel, because I really felt what he had written, because it's music that I grew up with and grew up singing.
We hear examples of you using that upper range in several other pieces. And another place in which we hear them is Henry Burley's Five Songs of Lawrence Hope.
Call me not to a secret place.
Can you talk about these pieces, please?
I mean, first of all, it's one of my favorite song cycles. And then, again, I didn't know anything about it. Like, I only knew Burley for his spirituals. And I mean, you know, of course, he wrote these spirituals and gave Black artists a platform by, you know, rewriting these spirituals and making them classical. So they're very, very important. And spirituals to me, you know, are, you know, near and dear to my heart because they kind of combine those worlds of gospel and opera. But then his songs too were just, it was completely blown away by, you know, going through these songs for the first time. So much passion, even like some like operatic moments where it's, you know, gets really big. And then like really, really soft. To really be flexible with my voice. And going back to your point, you know, that's the one of the beauties of recording and, you know, singing art song in general, which is why, you know, I love song, is that you're able to find different, you know, colors and take risks with art song because it's just you and the piano. And I think, you know, you're not competing against an orchestra. It's just you telling the story. And, you know, with the Burley, especially, you know, that was a piece where I felt right at home because I felt able to use my voice to its full capacity. And Burley just wrote and set that text so beautifully.
And we shouldn't neglect to share how Burley inspired Dvorak, who then inspired other American composers when he was here. Would you like to share the relationship that they had when Dvorak was here teaching?
Yeah, Dvorak, you know, was teaching at the conservatory, New Music Conservatory in New York, and that's where he met Burley, and they, you know, they became good friends, and he was very interested in Black music, and, you know, it impacted some of Dvorak's, you know, greatest hits. And I think that's the thing, too, about this idea of wanting to highlight Black composers. You know, they're just great composers in general, and they did so much to influence American music, which is so important to recognize.
The music of Margaret Bonds is being rediscovered, I would say, and now finally getting recorded more. And you've selected her three dream portraits. Can you tell us about each of those, please? And they were written at the height of the Civil Rights Movement, so they have a very deep meaning.
Oh, yeah. I mean, her relationship with Langston Hughes is quite special, and, you know, they're both just responding to the things that are happening at the time. And I, you know, I had to have Margaret Bonds on this program, and the three dream portraits just seem to fit the theme of the Black experience in America as well, and this ideas of dreams of a new day. All three of these pieces are, I find, things that I can relate to, even though they're written during the Civil Rights Movement. They're parallels to now, which is why I'm able to connect to them, because I understand what that's like to perform, and then you step off that stage and you're just a Black man that's being profiled. They don't see me as an opera singer or performer, and that's, you know, how I, my take on the Minstrel Man. And Dream Variations. It's just the celebration of what it's like to be, just to be comfortable in my skin.
To fling my arms wide in some place in the sun, to whirl and to dance till the white day is done.
Those three pieces are really important to add to this album because, I mean, they're set beautifully, and Langston Hughes just really captures what it's like to be, you know, Black in America, especially the I-2. I mean, it's so passionate. I have a right to sit at this table. I am equal to you.
I do. Send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes. But I love,
you know, it's something that still, when I feel those moments of, like, growing up in Virginia, like, having my own experiences of dealing with racism, I tap into those experiences. You know, we have come a long way, but there's still a ways to go. You know, even going back to talking with my dad and this whole idea of, what, you know, where it's always like we're dreaming and still cannot get to, you know, where we're going. But like, I don't have to deal with segregated Jim Crow. But at the same time, you know, there's still so much racism and, you know, we still have to be aware that the dream is not yet realized. On one level, when I look back at my dad's experience and talking with him, like, I realized that the things that they fought for meant something because it got us to now. And like, I don't have to, you know, go to the Chicago bus and get order to sit into the back. Like, I can sit wherever I want. But I hope that, also recognizing that we still have a lot of work to do so that future generations don't have to deal with the things that we're going through now. When I think of the George Floyd killing and plenty of other things that have happened in previous years that have sparked all of this unrest. And, you know, there's still issues that we have to deal with in America to, you know, keep it going forward. And so these songs sort of highlight that and my own personal experience.
I want to ask you about the song cycle Mortal Storm by Robert Owens, and in particular, the song Genius Child.
The cycle as a whole really struck me. It's so unusual. Like, I couldn't find it anywhere. Like, it was, I've heard about the Genius Child and the Faithful One. I found those in the anthology. But when I went to type in the whole Mortal Storm cycle, there was nothing. Like, there was no recordings. Luckily, I found the site and I ordered it. And I just was really taken to Robert Owens' writing. I think he loved the Germanic language because you'll see in his writing that it's in English and then he always has the German below it. And it's all so operatic and so big. And then the Genius Child, you really get that. I mean, that piano, I think we probably did like 5 or 6 takes of that one. It's music that's really energized and really grabs you. And that was something that I really wanted to highlight. Just takes you on this journey, and it's really beautiful what he did with the text. More Langston Hughes text, actually.
What struck me about that text and that song is that it kind of pulls the entire recording together in terms of the meaning behind it. I mean, from what I've read here, it says that the poem, it not only speaks of the many men and women killed by lynching or the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., but also of those 4 children in Alabama who were killed in that church bombing. So it just felt like it kind of brought all these stories together in this one song.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing about this album. Like, there's still things I'm even discovering. Like, when I first initially set out to do it, you know, I wanted to tell new stories. I wanted to highlight Black composers. But then this theme just sort of developed along the way that's, you know, really powerful and very, you know, meaningful to me about what it's like to be Black in America and telling our stories and, you know, just bringing attention to all these things as well.
You're performing your own arrangement of Richard Farina's Birmingham Sunday, and you're playing the piano. Tell me about that arrangement and why this piece is a fitting conclusion to the recording.
Yeah, I heard about this piece kind of at the same time when I was looking into the Ballad of Birmingham. I was doing some research and found Spike Lee's documentary about the bombing. And at the end, or the beginning of that, they play Joan Baez's. They played that arrangement. Just something that struck me of the recurring theme of, and the choir kept singing of freedom, and actually mentioning the names of the girls.
That cold autumn morning, no, I saw the sun, and Addie Mae Collins, her number was one. In an old Baptist church, there was no need to run, and the choir kept singing of freedom.
And there's something about that that just felt like a kind of like an ending credit to the album. Like, The Genius Child was a good place to end it, but then it's just sort of like kind of circling back to the story, but then with this theme of the choir kept singing of freedom, and this idea of what that, you know, of the dream of being free and of having equality across the board. And, you know, this was something that just felt like I wanted to arrange and say it in my own way. But I really wanted that to be a part of the album and kind of had that, you know, just sort of be something to think about as people listen. And this piece is so beautiful.
And the choir kept singing of freedom.
What are you hoping listeners will take away from the music on this recording?
You know, I hope listeners will come away, one, with more interest in Black composers that are even beyond this album, because of course I couldn't feature all the Black composers in song because the album would be like 9 hours long or more. But, you know, I hope they come away with, oh man, I never heard of Robert Owens' Mortal Storm. Like, what else did he do? Or like, oh, Margaret Bonds, like, what else does she have out there? Hope they come away with more of an interest in seeking and listening to what these Black composers did, because it's absolutely incredible. And, you know, some of these pieces, you know, like the two Black churches, the dream portraits, they come away really thinking, having conversations. I hope it sparks conversations about what we can do to continue to make real, long-lasting change. And so we can get to a place where we can stop dreaming and it's actually a reality. We move forward in that way.
And the choir kept singing the freedom.
Will Liverman with Dreams of a New Day. Thanks to Valerie Kaler, our producer of New Classical Tracks, with technical assistance from Michael Osborne. Since you're clearly a music fan, I want to tell you about another podcast, too. It's called the Piano Puzzler Podcast. Each week, host Fred Child invites composer Bruce Adolph into the studio to play one of his brilliant musical mind games. Bruce takes a familiar tune and disguises it in the style of a classical composer. Then a contestant calls in to try to solve the riddle. It's a lot of fun. If you think you're up for the challenge, subscribe to The Piano Puzzler wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're enjoying this podcast, New Classical Tracks, the best thing that you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it, help spread the word, and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Marker.
And I can't do much more than to sing you a song. I'll sing it so softly it'll do no one wrong. And the choir keeps singing of freedom. And the choir keeps singing of freedom.